Welcome to the Emergency Medicine Cases Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hellman, bringing you Canada's brightest minds in emergency medicine from EMC Studios in Toronto. EM Cases is part of SREMI, Schwartz-Reisman Emergency Medicine Institute, the nonprofit organization dedicated to improving EM care through research and education. The opinions expressed on this podcast are intended for information and education purposes only and should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified practicing physician. This episode is brought to you by Easy Recess, the resuscitation assistant. This amazing app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, treatment algorithms, all in under three clicks. Rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface. Try the app for free with the promo code EMCases or visit easyrecess.com/EMCases. That's easyrecess.com/EMCases. This past summer, it became quite apparent that forest fires were becoming a problem. One of the consequences of the forest fires was more air pollution. And it turns out that the incidence of asthma is quite a bit higher if the air in your neighborhood is more polluted. So the more nitrogen dioxide and carbon monoxide in the air, the more asthma. In fact, a recent study out of Calgary in Canada suggested that there were 13% more asthma exacerbations presenting to EDs when there was visible wildfire smoke in the city. Anyway, we're seeing more asthma in EDs, and unfortunately, there are still a lot of totally preventable deaths from asthma. I think we can do better risk stratifying and managing these patients. So I asked a friend and colleague of mine, master clinician ED doc at North York General Hospital in Toronto, Dr. Lior Sommer, to update us on the state of the art of ED management of asthma. Welcome back, Dr. Sommer.
Thank you so much for having me again. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Excelente. And new to EM Cases, ED and transport doc from London, Ontario, Canada, Dr. Samir Mal. Welcome, Dr. Mal.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. It was actually Dr. Burke Tillman, who most of you have probably heard on EM Cases before, who suggested that I reach out to Dr. Mal to get him on the show, because Dr. Mal actually helped train Dr. Tillman, and he's so awesome. We just assumed that you are awesome too, which I'm sure you are.
I'm going to do my best to fill those shoes, but Burke is a phenomenal clinician. I'm proud to have trained with him and had a small part to play in what he's become now.
Awesome. Actually, could you just tell us a little bit more about your professional background? You've done air transport. You've trained in ICU. You've trained in the ED. What's your thing?
Absolutely. So my main thing is I'm an emergency physician and trauma team leader here at London Health Sciences Center in London, Ontario, associate professor of emergency medicine with Western University. My kind of real love in acute care and resuscitative medicine has always been in the transport and retrieval environment. So I've been fortunate enough to work as a retrieval physician with the Sydney Air Ambulance Service in Sydney, Australia, and as well with a retrieval trauma physician with London's Air Ambulance in London, England. Both those experiences have translated into me now working as a transport physician here with the Orange Air Ambulance in Ontario, and looking to bring some of my international experience and credentials to Canada to improve the transport environment that we have in Ontario.
Excellent. We won't start with the case this time because we got a lot to cover in this two-part podcast. So let's start with the diagnosis of asthma. Now, usually the diagnosis of asthma is quite obvious, with the patient usually having recurrent exacerbations and visiting the ED many times. But sometimes it's not so obvious. And sometimes those recurrent exacerbations could be something as sinister or more sinister, like a PE or something. So, Dr. Mal, before we dive into asthma itself, could you just give us some examples of some of the asthma mimics? You know, not everything that wheezes is asthma, and asthma doesn't always wheeze. So how do you differentiate asthma from these asthma mimics?
It's important to maintain a wide differential diagnosis. So you kind of resuscitate while you differentiate. So, you know, you're likely not going to run into too much trouble throwing some basic treatment at someone who comes in with a wheeze, but it's important to always take a step back and make sure that you've considered all potential diagnoses in these individuals. So common things that we always see, anaphylaxis is a common mimic, and the history and physical exam is really key in this one with differentiating anaphylaxis. There's vocal cord dysfunction, however, that often presents with more stridorous sounds, stridorous respirations that can be heard from across the room, which, you know, with some experience is a very different sound than what a traditional wheeze is. Patients presenting with pneumothoraces, pneumonias also can trick you sometimes. And, you know, we talk about some of these classic physical exam findings, but oftentimes you really need to rely on your history, your physical, and some of the ancillary tests, you know, especially once we start talking about cardiac asthma and heart failure presenting with wheeze as well. I think it's really important to get good at just basic bedside thoracic ultrasonography, which can help differentiate some of these, looking for either extra fluid in the lung or cardiac contractility. You're looking for lung sliding for potential pneumothoraces. That, in conjunction with some basic chest x-rays, a physical exam, and a detailed history, can really help lead you in the right direction.
Excellent. Yeah, you mentioned Strider there, and I hope I've never missed an upper airway obstruction thinking that it's wheeze, but my understanding is that this can sometimes get mixed up. Dr. Sommer, could you just, you know, you being our go-to emergency ENT expert on EM cases, could you just give us a few tips and tricks about how to differentiate Strider from wheeze? There's the obvious: Strider is inspiratory and wheeze is expiratory. But first of all, I guess, why do they get mixed up? And then how do you differentiate them?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think really the problem is that when we hear noisy breathing, often we associate that with the most common cause for noisy breathing that we are aware of, and that's asthma, because asthma is just so common. We see it so often. And so we get these patients who present with noise as they breathe, and we often get kind of locked in or railroaded into having a cognitive bias that this is a wheeze. And I think that's actually really common. So you'll read the triage note. The triage says patient wheezy for the past 3 days. And when you go and examine them, you expect to hear a wheeze. But like you mentioned, Strider is predominantly an inspiratory sound, and asthma is predominantly a disease of expiration. And so the wheezing we hear in asthma is typically an expiratory wheeze, whereas the Strider that we hear with upper airway obstruction tends to happen mostly on inspiration. Now, that being said, the Strider and wheezing is mostly turbulent airflow. And so you can actually generate expiratory sounds from Strider as well. So you have to be cautious that you're not missing something. And I can tell you that I've seen more than a couple cases of patients who are treated for a few days, sometimes with multiple ED visits, for quote unquote wheeze, who ended up having an upper airway issue. I've seen one patient who had a large vocal cord tumor who was treated for COPD. He had a history of COPD, but treated for 3 days, shortness of breath, multiple rounds of puffers and steroids. And then when he actually had upper airway visualization, he had an airway tumor that was causing his shortness of breath. So keeping that in your mind when you're seeing these patients and not having that cognitive bias that all noisy breathing is wheezing, consider Strider. Even this morning I was working, I had a patient who came in with shortness of breath. She had Strider because of vocal cord dysfunction.
I've had a few similar cases. One that stands out for me is a guy who came in just with Strider at rest, and it was called wheeze by the triage nurse, and everyone else said it was wheeze, and he said it was wheeze. And then when I went to listen to him carefully, I was like, that is not wheeze, that's Strider. And then I threw an NP scope down his nose, and he had like 2 millimeter opening. So that was a little bit scary. He went to the OR.
It is amazing what people will tolerate.
Yeah, absolutely. So given that asthma is so common, like Dr. Sommer just said, it is tricky sometimes. We do have to kind of stop and pause and consider other diagnoses besides an asthma exacerbation in these supposedly wheezy patients. But once you know that you're dealing with an asthma exacerbation and not a pneumothorax or an upper airway lesion or CHF or something else, then you need to think about risk stratification, because we do see tons of these patients, and most of them, thankfully, aren't that sick. So when deciding on what to do with patients who present to the ED with an asthma exacerbation, it's important to risk stratify them, because we need to know how much to worry about them, what medications to throw at them, what their disposition is going to be. It basically dictates the entire management of the patient going forward. So, Dr. Sommer, how do you risk stratify asthma patients in the emergency department?
Asthma is one of those diseases where it really does come down to history and physical. Like so much we do in emergency medicine, history and physical is key for asthma. And that goes for risk stratifying our patients as well. The history, in particular, how has their asthma been over the past 6 to 12 months? Have they needed multiple ED visits? So more than 3 in a year is considered a major risk factor for death in asthma. Have they required hospitalization for asthma? 2 in the past year is considered a major risk factor. Have they required critical care due to asthma. So non-invasive ventilation or intubation for asthma. Obviously, that's going to make you much more concerned about an asthma patient. There are other specific markers like peak expiratory flow and predicted FEV. Those are also predictive of poor asthma, but most patients don't know about them when you ask them. You can look that up in their chart. You also have to ask them about, have they actually been using their asthma medication? If they're going through the Ventolin like gangbusters, so if they've used more than a couple of canisters of Ventolin over the past couple of weeks, that should make you very concerned. Either their asthma is not optimized very well, or they're going through a very bad asthma exacerbation that needs active treatment. Are they currently on steroids and despite that have bad asthma? That is a higher risk patient for sure. And then what's their physical exam look like? Do they come in hypoxic in extremis? Is their respiratory rate more than 30? Are they diaphoretic? Are they agitated? Can they not speak? So what they actually look like when they walk in is going to give you a lot of information. That's without ever laying a stethoscope on them. You can get all that information when you walk in the room. And a lot of that is inherent to what we do. We don't even think about it very much. We walk in and we see that patient and they're tripoding, diaphoretic, they look bad. But it's easy to document and think about when you actually go through it in a rigorous way. And finally, what is the patient's comorbid conditions? Do they have underlying congestive heart failure, other lung diseases? Do they live in a low socioeconomic status? Do they have psychiatric illness that's going to make it difficult for them when they're discharged from hospital? Those are big predictors of patients who are going to do poorly with their current asthma exacerbation.
Excellently reviewed there. I just want to go over those because there's actually a lot of stuff that you packed in there. So when it comes to risk stratifying your patient that's in the throes of an asthma exacerbation, some of the key things to ask about and to think about are previous asthma badness, ICU stays, intubations, frequent ED visits, if they're on steroids or recently on steroids, on physical exam, if they have signs of respiratory distress, if they have comorbidities. And then one thing to add there is if they have an allergic reaction with their asthma, that puts them at very high risk too, like the tragic case of Max McKenzie that we discussed a few episodes ago. So those are some of the factors that we need to consider in terms of risk stratification. We certainly don't want to make the mistake of under risk stratifying them and prematurely sending them home. I want to talk a little bit more about the really sick asthmatic on presentation to the ED. Dr. Sommer, you had mentioned diaphoretic, tripoding. But I want to get into a little bit more granular detail about that. Dr. Mel, when would you suspect life-threatening asthma? So you walk into the room and you're thinking, I might need to intubate this patient. What are the kinds of things that you're looking for?
Absolutely. So if we kind of just think about the pathophysiology of asthma and it being a disease of ventilation and not oxygenation, so your lungs just get so tight, these patients aren't moving any air. So at that point, their CO2 is arising. Immediately, if you walk into a room and you have a patient who has the all-feared silent chest where they're not moving any air enough to create any turbulent flow and you don't hear anything on auscultation, that's immediately life-threatening in my mind. That same patient who is now drowsy or confused, like oftentimes the people we're talking about with asthma exacerbations presenting to the emergency department tend to be otherwise kind of younger, potentially fewer other comorbidities. So that same individual who's now drowsy and confused because their CO2 levels are critically high, that's an absolute marker of someone who's potentially life-threatening. Other patients, if you're dyspneic at rest without any activity, sitting in bed, tripoding, using your accessory muscles, abdominal breathing, diaphoresis, those are all signs to me that this patient needs immediate resuscitation and you are unlikely to leave this patient's bedside anytime soon.
Yeah. Again, not everything that wheezes is asthma and asthma doesn't always wheeze. In fact, the sickest patients are the ones that are not wheezing. Dr. Sommer, I want to talk a bit more about the value of peak expiratory flow that you mentioned when we were talking about risk stratification. You know, it makes sense that peak flow could help risk stratify patients and help us decide which patients are safe to go home and which patients might need to be admitted. You know, if they can't expire well, they'll probably run into trouble. And we know that the physical exam alone doesn't seem accurate enough to determine when someone has recovered from an asthma exacerbation. So in terms of being comfortable sending them home, which asthma patients do you think need a peak expiratory flow in the ED before and after treatment, which is kind of typically what's recommended, and why?
Peak expiratory flow is a little complicated for me. It's a test that I really want to like because it feels objective. It feels measurable. But unfortunately, I don't think there's the data there to support its use, especially as a single marker of admission versus discharge criteria. It's just not good enough. So there is some information on its use at home for patients to assess their own deterioration. If they feel like they're getting worse, they can use peak expiratory flow and be trained on its use at home as an objective marker of their own asthma severity. But when it comes to its use in the emergency department, the data is not nearly as robust. For sure, we cannot use this on our sickest patients. It's useless. When the patients are so sick that they can't expire in a meaningful way, it's not going to be useful for you. So it's really in that group of patients that we'd like to use it in, where we think we're making them better and they're potentially dischargeable. So they're in that kind of moderate to mild asthma exacerbation where we can have a documentation of a peak expiratory flow that's adequate and makes us feel better that they're going to actually improve enough to be discharged. So it's this data point that can be used in patients who are being treated with our usual asthma treatment, and we can use it before and after, but certainly not in the sickest patients. And it can't really be used alone in a decision pathway. It needs to be used in addition to the other things that we'd normally do to assess a patient and their response to treatment.
Is it fair to say that it doesn't need to be done routinely?
I think that's totally fair. And I know that CAPE would back us up. That's the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians. Their policy is that it really doesn't have a huge say in who is going to be admitted or discharged. And there's data to suggest that peak expiratory flow alone is not predictive of the need for admission and discharge. There are studies from 1999 that were done in CHEST. So it doesn't need to be done. Could it be useful? Absolutely. It is effort dependent. So some patients are capable of doing it and some patients are not capable of doing it. If you find it useful, I think that's totally reasonable, but it doesn't need to be done.
I personally never used to use peak expiratory flow. And then I think probably about 5 years ago, I started using it again. And I do find it, maybe it's just to make myself feel better, but I just feel really good when that patient can blow over 300 on the peak expiratory flow and they feel better and they're not wheezing anymore and their SAT is fine and they want to go home. It's just a nice way to kind of close the package and feel confident that they're going to be safe going home. The other thing I really like about the peak flow is, as you were saying, that there is some pretty good evidence that if they use it at home, that might prevent them from having to come back to the emergency department and even have a life-threatening exacerbation. So once I've used it in the emergency department, I show them how great it is at helping us make a decision to send you home. And then I said, well, you know, you can do the same thing at home and to see when you might need to come back to the emergency department or early on as there might be needing more puffers. If they're blowing really well on the peak expiratory flow, then they can try a few more puffers and see how it goes. But I fully understand that if you're working in an extremely busy emergency department, resources are limited. It might be hard to get a hold of one of these things. And then many patients aren't able to blow properly through it. I can understand why you'd want to skip it. And it's great to know that CAPE supports us in skipping it if we feel the need to.
I think just the one thing I'd like to add there is it's great when it all fits together. The patient feels better, the SATs are better, the vitals are better, and the peak flow is better. But the problem is when it doesn't all fit together, which piece of information do you drop? So I'll never drop the fact that the patient isn't feeling better. If a patient's not feeling better, if the SATs aren't better, if their respiratory rate isn't better, that patient isn't better. So irrespective of whether the peak flow has improved or not, that patient is probably not dischargeable. Versus the opposite, when the patient's feeling better, the SATs are better, the wheezing is disappearing, but the peak flow hasn't changed yet, that may be a piece of information that I'm okay not being consistent with the story because it doesn't always fit and it's a difficult thing to do well sometimes.
Fair enough. I mean, just like any test in emergency medicine, we need to be careful of the false positives, false negatives, and not get lulled into a sense of security when they can blow well on the peak flow, but the rest of their clinical picture is not looking good. That would be a pitfall to then send them home just based on the peak flow.
Or to keep the patient based on a peak flow alone as well, because I don't think that has value in and of itself.
Treat the patient, not the test.
Good way of putting it. I just want to take a little break to tell you that by far the most popular blog series we've ever had on the EM Cases website is the ECG Cases blog with ECG Master Jesse McLaren. Now, you've probably also heard Dr. McLaren on our EM Quick Hit series. Well, I've got big news for you. Jesse McLaren now runs online ECG interpretation courses for every level of experience. The name of the course is Hearts. This is the best way to up your ECG interpretation skills and pick up those life-saving ECG changes. There's an upcoming course designed specifically for emergency medicine residents and registrars on May 18th to May 25th, and an advanced Hearts course for practicing EM docs June 23rd to 30th. And it's all online, so easy to join. He even offers courses for paramedics and medical students too. These are expertly designed, clinically focused, simple and systematic approaches to ECG interpretation specifically for emergency medicine providers. All the info and the easy registration is at heartsecgcourse.com. That's all one word, heartsecgcourse.com. Let's move on now to ED treatment for asthma. And the first question that seems to always come up is the great MDI versus NEBS debate. Now, there's pretty good evidence, I understand, that metered dose inhalers are as good as nebulizers for delivering your beta agonist to your asthma patient in the ED. What are the advantages and disadvantages of each of those methods? When do you use MDIs? When do you use NEBS? And when we're talking about MDIs, just to be clear, we're talking about a puffer with a spacer attached, or a valve holding chamber, as it's sometimes called. So Dr. Summer, what do we need to know about NEBS versus MDIs?
Well, I think COVID changed this for all of us, because I have to tell you, in the emergency departments that I've worked in, pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, this has totally changed. We used to use nebulizers for almost everyone with asthma pre-2019, and now we use nebulizers for almost nobody with asthma. And there's reason for that. The major reason is obviously because of transmissibility of aerosol particles. Look, there's not a lot of data to support that there's actually increased transmissibility, but we know that there's a lot of stuff floating up into the air in an aerosolized way with nebulizers. So there's waste as well as spread of air into a potentially an open space. So that's number one, is it's much easier to deliver the medicine into the place it needs to be in a closed chamber. So the use of an MDI with a spacer is more efficient in getting the medicine into the patient rather than into the room. That's a huge advantage, I think. The other thing is, we don't send patients home with nebulizers very often, occasionally. So having the patient learn how to use an MDI properly in the emergency department is a huge advantage, because number one, we can send them home with the exact same setup that we're using in the emergency department, and we can show them exactly how to take the medication in an appropriate way so we know that they're getting it. I can't tell you how many patients I see not using a spacer and how ineffective that is. Last thing is, I'll give you the disadvantage of using MDIs. It is more labor intensive for the nursing staff. There's no question in my mind. So in some patients, we can teach them how to use the MDI, and you can have that upfront time, and that is much more labor intensive for the nurses. And then later, the patients can hopefully give it to themselves in most scenarios. But it's much easier to squirt a little bit of salbutamol into a nebulizer, slap it on the patient, and walk away for 15 minutes than it is to use multiple sprays of MDI into a spacer and stand there and watch the patient inhale properly.
All right. So suffice to say that you're on the side of MDIs, generally speaking, unless the patient is incapable of using the MDIs. Let's say they're just too sick to. I guess the only other situation where you might use NEBS instead of MDIs is if you just don't have the nursing staff.
Yeah. And again, even in that situation, it may be more worthwhile to just give the first few puffs to the patient myself using a spacer, as long as they're capable of learning it. And most people are. It's not a difficult thing to learn. I'd rather spend that little bit of time up front and then know that I don't have to spend it later, because often they're going to be getting back-to-back or multiple rounds of medication.
Good point. Dr. Mal, any comments about MDIs versus NEBS?
I try to do MDIs in any patient who is physically capable of getting an MDI. So not that life-threatening asthma that we were talking about earlier, but if someone is able to, is awake enough and cooperative enough to perform an MDI, one, I can guarantee I'm going to get better medication delivery to the lung parenchyma. And secondly, I'm setting that patient up for success on discharge where they're able to administer that same medication at home just as effectively.
We've been talking a lot about risk stratification. I want to get a little bit more specific about risk stratification when it comes to actual treatment and guiding our treatment. Treatments are going to change depending on whether the patient's asthma exacerbation is mild, moderate, or severe. Now, there are these categories, mild, moderate, and severe for asthma, for outpatient asthma. In the emergency department, it's not quite as clear what these categories are. From a practical perspective, Dr. Mel, can you go over for us how you decide in your head what kind of category the patient is in? I mean, we've talked about the risk stratification, but how do you decide what treatments you're actually going to give based on their risk stratification?
It's a combination of factors with respect to a patient's symptoms, some of their physical signs, and then some kind of functional assessments at the bedside. So purposes of this podcast are obviously talking about the patients who are ill enough to present to an emergency department. So immediately to me, that paints a picture in my head of someone who at the very least is a little bit dyspneic at rest, probably not speaking in full sentences, you know, between the moderate and severe. You really think of someone who is speaking in small phrases versus someone who's severe and only maybe speaking a few words at a time. You know, secondly, with their level of alertness, someone who is in a moderate exacerbation in my mind is kind of really working to breathe, is uncomfortable, is kind of unconsciously asking you for help with their respirations and their diaphoresis in front of you. And then there's the more severe categories where patients are extraordinarily agitated or potentially even somnolent. With respect to physical signs, so we talk about respiratory rate, and I use something in the high 20s or definitely 30 as my main marker for someone who's really at high risk of deteriorating and needs some aggressive therapy in the next 30 to 60 minutes to prevent them from heading in that direction. The use of accessory muscles in adult patients is definitely concerning. Loud wheezes from the edge of the room, or even more concerning, no wheezes at all, like we spoke about before, really help differentiate the moderate to severe patients. And then lastly, some functional assessments. We did spend some time talking about peak flow. I use it intermittently in the emergency department as one singular physical exam piece in my larger puzzle. You know, I think we're at a point now in medical training that I don't think there's many listeners out there who are going to be using just peak flows and only peak flows for this assessment. But we generally talk about somewhere between 40-60% of predicted peak flow for patients who are having a moderate exacerbation and below 40% for patients who are severe. The really critical ones, they're not going to be cooperative for a peak flow. So no point even in talking about that. And then lastly, other physical exam signs like your saturation. We mentioned before that this is a disease of ventilation, not oxygenation. So if you see your asthma patient now starting to require some supplemental oxygen as well, that's a patient that you need to be very concerned about.
Just one aspect I'd like to highlight is that importance of vital signs, and the particular vital sign that usually does not get checked properly is the one that's critical in asthma, and that's the respiratory rate. Particularly in children, because it's tough to count their respiratory rate, especially at triage if they're crying. And the only way to get a really good respiratory rate is to actually examine the child without their clothes on, so you can see their abdomen and chest rising. So doing that exam with bare skin to get a proper respiratory rate is critical, because it's amazing what children will tolerate. You get these kids that are breathing at 60 or 70 breaths a minute, and you didn't know it until you lifted all the layers off.
Absolutely. Back to the basics. So important. And now a word from one of our sponsors, EZ Recess, the resuscitation assistant. Did you know that EZ Recess is brought to you by a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving care in resuscitation? This means that every dollar from your subscription goes to improving EZ Recess. But not only that, thanks to your contributions, Easy Recess can be made affordable for healthcare workers in developing countries so that they can also deliver the best care possible to their patients. If you want to help them in their mission, download Easy Recess and use promo code EMCases to get your first 2 months free, or visit easyrecess.com/EMCases for more details. So we've talked about identifying the really sick patient. Let's go through what treatments you're actually going to give. So, Dr. Mal, You talked about sort of the moderate and severe. What's your sort of escalation of medication considerations for these patients who are moderate, severe? And in part two, we're going to talk about life-threatening, but let's just talk about the ones who are moderate and severe. What's your treatment algorithm, so to speak?
These are patients who I definitely treat aggressively up front, because in my mind, you really have a short window within the patient's trajectory in the next 30 minutes to a couple of hours to really turn this patient around and prevent them from having more air trapping, more dyspnea, and then kind of hitting the asthma spiral of death. So these are patients who I do treat quite aggressively. Up front, we talk about the ABCs. Let's reverse that a little bit. Here in asthma, it's breathing, circulation, and airway. Airway is our absolute last consideration, which we'll get to later in this podcast. With respect to improving their breathing, all these patients are going to get inhaled beta-2 agonists. So here in Canada, salbutamol would be our medication of choice. When possible, using a metered dose inhaler is the delivery method of choice, giving patients 6 to 12 puffs every 10 to 20 minutes over the course of an hour, or just aggressively really trying to bronchodilate their lungs. If they're unable to tolerate a metered dose inhaler, then the option exists to nebulize 2.5 milligrams of salbutamol every 10 to 20 minutes. On top of that, I'm always adding on an inhaled anticholinergic agent as well, so ipratropium. So these kind of override smooth muscle constriction and the consequences of increased secretions with activating your parasympathetic nervous system. So in terms of the dose here, you want to get at least a milligram to a milligram and a half of an inhaled anticholinergic on board with these patients. So giving 0.5 milligrams every 10 to 20 minutes up to about three doses is what I do in conjunction with my inhaled beta-2 agonist. And then if you have a meter dose inhaler, giving, again, six puffs every 10 minutes or so for three doses, just so that that is on board. And there's good evidence showing the combination of those two decreases hospital admission and length of stay rates. Beyond that, anyone who's now sick enough to be getting both of these treatments over the courses of an hour is also going to qualify for systemic corticosteroids. If this patient is awake, alert, and has a functioning GI tract, oral prednisone is a great choice. I think depending on the clinician you talk to, you'll have 10 different answers of which steroid is necessarily best. But in my mind, I either stick with prednisone at a milligram per kilogram orally, or if the patient's unable to tolerate oral steroids because of their dyspnea, then methylprednisolone at a dose of at least 100 to 125 milligrams seems to be what the research says. It seems like higher doses don't really get you any more bang for your buck, so to speak. And then lastly, I am a fan of magnesium. The evidence for it has been kind of lacking. However, typically when these patients present with moderate to severe exacerbations, I'm giving magnesium as a greater package of probably 5, 6, 7 other drugs. So it's hard to narrow down exactly which singular agent actually made the improvement. But I think the synergy of getting the bronchial smooth muscle relaxation with the magnesium is important. And we probably have been underdosing it. I typically tend to give these patients 2 grams over the course of 10 to 15 minutes. I repeat that times 2 to 3 in the first hour, just kind of piggybacking off the obstetrical literature there, where I think we are vastly underdosing the magnesium in the emergency department, which may have some reason why we're not seeing maybe the effect that that we could. But it is safe. And I think in conjunction with the other medications that I've described, do get some synergistic effect to really throw the kitchen sink at these people, so to speak, so that you can prevent the terrible scenarios, which we're going to get into later on in the podcast.
All right, fantastic. So we're talking beta agonists, ipratropium, steroids, mag. Dr. Sommer, anything to add or any nuances about deciding on which treatments to give to which of those moderate to severe asthma exacerbation patients?
No, it's amazing how little this has changed over the past 20 years. This is the same treatment we've been giving for quite a while, but the small changes I think that have happened are we're much more likely to give back-to-back continuous treatments rather than episodic treatments. So usually I just order continuous treatments because it's easier to deliver and we're fairly certain that the patients are going to need those anyway. And then like Dr. Mal had mentioned, there has been a slight movement away from prednisone to dexamethasone, mostly based on the pediatric literature that shows that you need less compliance with medications because of the long half-life of dexamethasones. The patients are less likely to bounce back to the emergency department irrespective of their steroid use at home.
All right, great. So just to review there, we're giving salbutamol or short-acting beta agonists. I think they call it SABA in the States. So we're giving 6 to 12 puffs of MDIs times 3 back-to-back or continuously, really. or if you need to use nebs for whatever reason, three nebs back to back. We're giving ipratropium, again, three nebs or three rounds of six puffs of MDI back to back max, and then you stop there with ipratropium and you can keep on going with the short acting beta agonist. Give oral or IV steroids, but do realize that it takes a few hours to kick in. So when you go reassess them in 1 hour, it was not the steroid that improved them. If they are more on the severe side, consider giving magnesium sulfate. Start with 2 grams, and you'll want to repeat that a couple of times, up to about 6 grams, because we have historically probably underdosed magnesium sulfate for patients with asthma exacerbation. I want to talk a little bit about reassessment. So let's say you've given all these great medications. I guess the first question is, when are you going to reassess these patients? And when you do reassess them, what else are you going to give if they haven't gotten better?
With respect to reassessment, these are patients, again, who I try to be very aggressive with my treatment up front so that I prevent these patients from potentially getting a lot worse. So these are patients who I like to do a walk by in a busy tertiary care emergency department. These patients will have their MDIs administered by one of our trained acute care nurses or a respiratory therapist. So I'm fortunate in the shop I work at with that respect. But these are patients who I do try to do a walk by every 15 to 20 minutes after each kind of round of puffers to just quickly reassess. And using that just bedside clinical gestalt, like am I seeing the respiratory rate come down? Am I seeing a patient who's now able to converse in a few more words or sentences with me? Are they looking a little bit more comfortable sitting back in bed and no longer tripoding? Are they less agitated and more comfortable? Just using a combination of those factors. I'm definitely not doing a peak flow after each round of puffers, but do reassess these patients frequently. This is not a patient to go take your lunch break after the first round of puffers, that's for sure.
All right, so you're going to be reassessing them quite often. And then when you do reassess them, Dr. Mal, let's say they still have a respiratory rate of 26. They say that they're not feeling that much better. What's your next move?
Absolutely. So my next move at this point would be non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. So now we're really talking about a patient who's having at least a moderate into a severe exacerbation, who has failed traditional therapies with inhaled beta-2 agonists and anticholinergic agents. Perhaps this patient's respiratory rate is now staying too elevated, which is an issue in these asthma patients, which we appreciate in the intubated asthma patient, but I don't think gets enough love in the patients who are still kind of awake and sitting and talking to you. So these are patients who ultimately I will throw on some form of NIV and then continue with my therapies through the circuit.
All right, great. And Dr. Sommer, in terms of reassessment and when you do reassess them, if they're not doing as well as you'd like, what your next move is?
There's the ideal and then there's the reality of it. The ideal is you want to see these patients over and over and over again, but those of us who work in our current resource-strapped environment know that it's difficult to do that because we have a heavy workload. We're seeing a lot of patients. And so obviously the patients who come in on the sicker side of things with a more severe exacerbation, those ones are going to get a lot more of my attention much more frequently. From standing at the bedside and watching them to reassessing them every 15 to 20 minutes. Now, the patients on the less severe side of things are going to get reassessed obviously less frequently. That's the reality of things. And so I may wait until they have their 3 back-to-back treatments, and then I'll go in and see them as soon as I can after that. And I think that's reasonable given where we work. We have to triage things appropriately. Now, what will I do if the patient is not improving after my first line treatment? That's a patient who's going to need admission to hospital. So absolutely, if they're really not doing well, I'm going to add non-invasive. I'm going to continue with my beta agonist therapy. Of course, I'll add magnesium if I haven't at this point. And if they're really doing poorly, they will need non-invasive and critical care admission.
A word from our sponsor, Metricade, the experts on scheduling systems. Since 2015, I've been using Metricade, the incredible self-scheduling system that has made my life and the lives of my colleagues so much easier. Metricade can really help minimize the drawbacks of shift work we all know so well by not only ensuring equitable distribution of shifts, but also integrating circadian rhythm-friendly recovery time into their algorithms. They minimize my sleep deprivation, which allows me to be a better EM doc on shift. I can take better care of my patients and still have energy left after my shifts to enjoy other aspects of my life. Check out metricade.com/emcases for more details on how this awesome scheduling system works. I want to move on now to discharging patients after an asthma exacerbation. And first, I want to talk a little bit about inhaled steroids, which we covered relatively recently on an EM Quick Hits, but it's so important that I think we need to cover it here. So Dr. Sommer, it turns out based on observational data that few patients who come to the ED with an asthma exacerbation receive a steroid inhaler at discharge. Why is it important to be sure to prescribe a steroid inhaler in addition to their beta agonist inhaler on discharge from the ED?
Look, we notoriously as eMERGE physicians have short attention spans. That's what we do. So we treat the patient in front of us, we make them feel better, and then we feel like we're kind of done. And the patient's gone home and they can deal with their primary care provider. But really, I think our role here is much bigger in that we want that patient to continue to be well in the future. And there's just excellent evidence and guidelines to tell us that to do that, to keep that patient out of the emergency department, out of the hospital, out of critical care, the evidence says give them inhaled corticosteroids. They need to be on that treatment for a prolonged period of time, not just until they're feeling better, but until their risk of deterioration is mostly gone away. So typically, I will be prescribing inhaled corticosteroid by metered dose inhaler for a minimum of 3 weeks, usually 6 weeks after their emergency visit. And if it's someone who's had repeated emergency visits, often I will do it continuously until they're reassessed by their primary care provider or asthma specialist. And the evidence supports that. We need to be doing that in order to keep these patients healthy and well.
So steroid inhalers for pretty much everyone who you're discharging from the emergency department. Excellent.
If you're bad enough to come into the emergency department because of an asthma exacerbation, you need most likely systemic corticosteroids short term and inhaled corticosteroids longer term.
And I guess that's probably the reason why we often miss it is because we put a lot of these patients on oral steroids and we probably figure, well, they're on oral steroids, they don't need the inhaled steroids, but the oral steroids are only for a few days and it's so important to have them on the inhaled steroid for many, many weeks.
And, you know, we also need to understand that there is a financial implication here as well. Those inhaled corticosteroids aren't cheap and they're not free. And so that can often be a hindrance to treating these patients appropriately and preventing them from bouncing back to the emergency department. And so don't be shy about asking that. And sometimes there are ways to mitigate that risk. And whether that's talking to the social worker at your hospital or actually dispensing a metered dose inhaler corticosteroid, that's a reasonable thing to do.
Totally agree. Dr. Sommer, you had mentioned earlier how it's nice to be able to teach our patients how to use the MDIs when we use them in the emergency department, and then they'll know how to use them properly at home. And we know the evidence suggests that if people don't use their inhalers properly, they will bounce back, there will be higher mortality. So it's so important. And again, it doesn't really seem like it's in our wheelhouse to be teaching patients how to use their MDIs, but it's so important in decreasing morbidity. How do you suggest we get patients to know how to use their MDIs properly? I mean, again, we don't really have time to sit down and teach them. Our nurses often don't have time to sit down and teach them. What kind of things can we employ to make sure that they're using their inhalers properly and that'll prevent them from bouncing back?
The most important part of this is just asking the question. So the first thing I do when I see someone who's come in with their asthma exacerbation, who's already on beta agonist therapy and inhaled corticosteroid by metered dose inhaler, is I ask them, do you use a spacing device to take your metered dose inhaler? And I would say at least half of the patients don't. And we know that as good as your technique is, and as long as you've been using it, if you do not use a spacing device, you are only getting a small percentage of that medication. Because using MDIs, as amazing as they are at delivering the medication, using them is really hard. Your timing has to be impeccable. And nobody's got impeccable timing, I'm sorry. So you have to use them with a spacer. And so number one, you got to ask the patient. And most of the patients kind of brush that off. I know how to use my inhaler, but it's amazing how little medicine they get. Most of it is going to end up in their oropharynx or the back of their hypopharynx, and it's never going to actually end up in their small airways and alveoli where it needs to be. So we got to ask. Once you've asked, they have to be shown how to do it at least once. And so if you work in a place where the nurses do it, make sure the nurses are trained to do it properly. If you work in a place where the respiratory therapists are going to deliver treatment, that's wonderful. Most of them know exactly how to do this. And it's totally worth that little bit of time up front, like I said, if you don't have somebody to do it, to show the patient how to do it yourself. And it takes a couple of minutes, and it's hard to take that couple of minutes because we have so many other things to do and we like to delegate things that we don't necessarily like doing. But sometimes it's worth that little bit of time investment to make sure that the patient isn't getting 20% of the medication, but rather 80% of the medication into their airway. And that's what studies have shown with radioactive labeling, that if patients don't use a spacer, they're getting only about 1 in 5 of those particles versus 4 out of 5 particles into their lower airways. Last thing is, if a patient really can't use one of those meter dose inhalers because they are hard, there are other delivery methods to get those medications into the patient's lungs. And so if you want to use a powdered inhaler or turbuhaler or something else, those are available for most of the medications on discharge. And those are easier to use because there's no timing involved. You just kind of click the spacer in and they inhale the powder. Some patients don't tolerate that because it can be a little bit of an irritant for them, but some patients find it way easier.
All right. So spacers for everyone. There are other options besides MDIs with the powdered medications. And one way or another, these patients do need to be taught how to do MDIs properly with a spacer. I want to talk a little bit more about discharge instructions. What else do you tell patients on discharge? Because again, you know, this isn't all the emergency stuff that we love to do, like resuscitating patients, but the evidence suggests that the discharge instructions for patients with asthma exacerbation actually make a difference to their outcome. So it's important to get the discharge instructions right. Dr. Mal, what do you usually tell your patients on discharge who are ready to go home?
Great question. So I think this is multifaceted. That education piece is key. I'm like you, where I tend to use peak flow in the patients that we're talking about, who I think I can really settle out and get discharged. So giving patients instructions on using that peak flow meter at home when they're feeling short of breath and with treatments to make sure that they see some objective improvement, and then giving them instructions that if you see it drop below 60 to 70% of where you were at, or most importantly, if you're just feeling worse, you need to come back to your closest emergency department. I think it's really important to try to, as much as possible, delineate what the triggers for these patients are and see, are there at least strategies that we can use to potentially mitigate future exacerbations, at least in the short term, while this patient is waiting to follow up with their family physician or with respirology. So to really go that next mile with this individual, get the history and what was the trigger? Was it exercise? And then can we talk about some strategies around trying to still stay healthy going forward while you're dealing with your asthma? Was it potentially pets in the home with a new roommate that you've moved into, potential other allergens that this patient's been exposed to, or other medications? I think it is important to at least pay some mind to these so that patients can also take charge of some of their own healing over the course of the next days and weeks. In conjunction with the medications that you're going to give, at least try to make some lifestyle modifications to prevent exacerbations in the future, because this is likely something that they're going to be living with for some length of time.
All right, Dr. Sommer, what kind of things do you make sure that you tell patients before they leave the emergency department?
Yeah, so I really emphasize the appropriate use of the discharge medications, particularly the long-term use of inhaled corticosteroids, because we know that there's evidence to support their use and that they prevent morbidity and mortality. So use the medications. Number two, quit smoking. I know it's easy for us to say, but asking the question of whether the patients smoke, because there's a huge overlap, and then telling them that quitting smoking is the best thing that they can do for their health. As corny as it sounds, it works a little bit. And that's a huge impact on that patient's potential morbidity, and again, for sure, their mortality, because smoking kills. We know that. It's straightforward. And then, yeah, finally, giving them good instructions on when to return. You feel sicker. You're using way more of your blue puffer. You got to come back to the emergency department. If you're having trouble breathing, even when you're sitting down and doing nothing, you got to come back to the emergency department.
Fantastic. So there's something called Asthma Canada, and you can go to their website. I think it's asthma.ca, and they have these action plans for patients. And it's easy enough to give these patients a sort of action plan. And as you were saying, Dr. Mal, to help them take charge of their own health and getting better, These action plans outline exactly when they should come back to the emergency department. And so that's something else that you can add on top of what you guys just said. Before we leave part one of our two-part series on asthma in the emergency department, any other last tricks or tips, pearls or pitfalls when it comes to asthma exacerbations? We're going to be talking about the crashing asthmatic in part two. So we'll leave those tips and tricks and pearls for part two. But anything else you wanted to add?
I think that my biggest take home is take the time to get the diagnosis right. So we started off the podcast by really emphasizing not all asthmatics are presenting with an asthma exacerbation and not everything that wheezes is asthma. So really take the time to get the diagnosis right. Once you do get the diagnosis right, make sure that you're really risk stratifying that individual in your mind using an array of strategies, not just one singular data point. So really, what is that patient looking like with the physical exam and maybe with some objective measures? And then in my mind, treating that patient aggressively in the emergency department to try to get them to turn the corner before they kind of really hit the point of no return. And then once they are feeling better, Dr. Summer really summarized some of the kind of softer skills that I think we need to emphasize amongst ourselves, me included, with really taking the time for education, letting patients know how important it is to use that steroid inhaler regularly, how important lifestyle modification factors can be for future exacerbations, because ultimately we're not just treating a disease that's presenting singularly in one moment. This is a patient who you want to avoid return emergency department visits over the course of the following weeks and months and years, because I think if we don't take the time to provide the proper education, this is someone who's going to be a repeat visitor to your emergency department.
I couldn't have summarized it better myself. Thanks so much, Dr. Val. You just saved me my summary. And Dr. Summer, any last words of wisdom when it comes to the non-life-threatening asthma exacerbation?
Just one last thing to add. There's a lot of apprehension in the community about corticosteroids. People really do not like the idea of being on them either short-term or long-term, but we know that they work and we know that they make people better. And so especially parents of younger children, ones who come in with recurrent asthma exacerbations, they don't like the idea often of their kids being on long-term treatment. And I often will put them on an inhaled corticosteroid for 6 months throughout the course of the winter if they've been in with multiple exacerbations. But we know that those patients are going to be healthier, are going to be in the hospital less, and are going to do better even on chronic medication. So it's really important to get that message across. Yes, I know I'm putting you on this medication. I know you don't want to be on it. I understand you have apprehensions about it, but it's important for you to continue to take it because you're going to be sicker without it rather than with it.
Excellent point. All right, so that about wraps it up for part one on our two-part series on asthma. While I have to admit that risk stratification and what puffers to use when is probably not the most exciting thing we do in EM, but we have to realize that these are very important in preventing morbidity and mortality in our patients who are living with asthma. In part two, we'll discuss the much more exciting and complicated management of the crashing asthmatic. So looking forward to your insights for part two, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.